Does Monday at the office feel like a storm? Not with Microsoft Copilot. That feeling when Copilot gets everyone up to speed instantly? It's sunny again. When Copilot simplifies complex data so your teams can act, that sun's shining on a beach. And when Copilot uncovers hidden insights, you're on that beach with your people and you find buried treasure. That's Microsoft Copilot. Learn more at Microsoft.com/AI for all.
End of intermission, part two.
I don't think most people with any kind of basis of knowledge of the Beatles' history that has any value still ascribe their disintegration squarely on Yoko. I think that the world is more coming around to, and there's certainly any number of forces involved, but the business was the absolute sharp end of the axe when it came to breakdown in group unity. But I do think that when you hear the whole of the discussion of January 13th after George leaves, before John and Yoko show up, and you get a part of that, but not all of it, in Get Back, they all seem to be pointing to John and Yoko as the big issue of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And it's clearly an element.
That day they are, until it's not. That's the crazy thing about that window, not to interrupt, but just to say that, sure, she's like the closest thing you can point to at that time. It's just like, okay, fucking Yoko, we knew it, of course. But then once John's back, you can see Paul giddily run up like, oh my God, he called me like a little girl and goes back to the phone. All of a sudden, Yoko has nothing to do with it.
Well, I guess what it speaks to is that you're sort of led to think, for years it was through the Let It Be film, oh, Paul and George had a tiff over that exchange of rehearsing two of us, and that was the frustrations. And then in the flower pot conversation, they seem to be focusing on that sort of how to rehearse and arranging songs as a element that led directly to that. But as soon as John's out of earshot, it's the others. It's Neil. It's Michael. It's Mal that are bringing up Yoko, or at least John and Yoko. I shouldn't just say Yoko. John and Yoko as the problem that informed George's beef and quitting in the first place. And all I'm saying in a roundabout way is that it's sort of undersold in the Get Back doc in a way that it's not on the tapes. They're not having the meeting about, oh, you know, poor George can't get a handle on how the Beatles are arranging their material these days. It's like, no, we understand his grievance that it comes down to, if we tell John to start leaving his woman at home, that he's going to quit the group. That's their issue at that moment.
And I'm saying, I get that. I totally understand why they are all talking that way, but you have to put it in perspective. And I'm wondering how the hell we drag it back to Double Fantasy, but in a way you can by saying this was a, I hate to be the guy, but this was a Northern white male clan being infiltrated by this avant-garde post-World War II female Japanese element. And it just wasn't easy for them to wrap their heads around. They just weren't in the headspace to roll with that, at that time. And it's completely understandable, but I'm just saying you have to look at it in light of what it is. That's all I'm trying to say.
And I'm not disagreeing with you, because you were present, I think, for the Nancy and Chris discussion, and Nancy explicitly telling how she wished that other Northern men had been as evolved as Paul and Linda were at that point. If that Paul existed in January 1969, maybe it would have been a different Beatles outcome.
Yeah, I'm not excusing any behavior on the part of John and Yoko from that point all the way up until the end. I'm simply saying that it has to be parsed, you know, separated somewhat from the art. That's all I'm trying to say is that, you know, and of course, many people recently have been having these discussions about art and behavior since, you know, Bill Cosby and all these different things that have come, make
sure
people come to terms with it, you know, all sorts of subtleties of this and shades and levels of it.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, they were artists and they were human beings. The human beings were a subject to their times, trying to be ahead of their times at times, trying to break through their times, you know, trapped by their times. But the art has a way of transcending that. That's why we love them, why we talk about them, why we think about them is that, and I'm including Paul and I'm including George and I'm including Ringo, you know, Yoko, all of them. The art has a way of being this subtext and this subversion and this hopefully better version sometimes of the person. That's how we kind of have to approach double fantasy. We have to say, okay, they're being as honest as they can be. What were they going for? Did they accomplish their goal? If their goal was to create, like, as you say, this almost theatrical conceptual version of their reality for people to mass ingest as a piece of art, yeah, they did. As a commercial piece of art, they created something that to me is still, we're talking about it now, so it's still challenging. You know, there's nothing not challenging about something like Dear Yoko on the same album as something like Beautiful Boys. Or like, as you said before, just like starting over on the same album as Kiss, Kiss, Kiss. There's something very, very dimensional about that record. I can't put my finger on it, but the fact we even perceive it as something that's kind of a sweet concoction of bliss or a kind of home life or whatever, it's kind of amazing because by today's standards, it would be considered total cutting edge stuff. Even the pop stuff, you'd be like, there's elements in the pop stuff, even John's stuff, where you'd be like, people don't do that now. It's right. Just kind of interesting, like the 50s influence and just different things.
Japanese gospel.
I mean, I don't know. I don't know where to begin. I just know that it's always been a pleasant listening experience, but I feel like it's grown for myself more. I've understood what I was hearing and more of understood who they were as people. I'm realizing that, like, they were trying to put the best version of themselves out there.
So it's gotten bigger, not smaller for you.
Yeah, it's gotten bigger. And that's all the Beatles try to do is they try to distill down the best. That's what they were doing, is putting the best version of themselves out there. Like, it was a team effort to create something. George Martin, all the engineers, everybody included, to put out this piece of plastic that would just enrich people's lives and make them better. And that's, at the end of the day, what John and Yoko are trying to do. They're trying to say, just like he says in that one interview, like, hey, we just want to say we went through the 60s too. We survived it. Here we are. And we're just like you. And this is our experience. What's yours?
Yeah.
That's kind of I'm paraphrasing. But, and I believe that. I really believe that. But it's 40 years on. It just takes on a different life. It can't help it. Most people don't even remember that time or weren't even around. So all you can do is take it for the piece of music it is.
And how you relate to it. What does it say to you?
Yeah. And I find it easier to relate to now because, kind of in a rough way of putting it, he's sort of taken on a McCartney-esque role and she's sort of taken on this Lennon-esque role in it. And they are, I think we had a conversation earlier about, he always sold her as being his follow-up as a partnership to Lennon McCartney.
Mm-hmm.
That's how we always sold Yoko. This is the album that makes me really believe it. I can really hear that symmetry. In many ways, she might even be one-upping him here and there on the record, and he allows her to do it. That's the amazing thing, is he's goading her on. I think we underestimate sometimes how much of a cheerleader for Paul John might have been because he wasn't as vocal about it. But I think secretly, we all know that he was incredibly proud of, and yes, I'll say it, discovering a Paul McCartney, as he is proud of discovering a Yoko.
That's absolutely what he was putting out into the world. It's like, I've worked with only two people. Those aren't bad choices, Paul McCartney and Yoko Ono.
No, exactly. Yeah. And I didn't want to believe it growing up or even past growing up. But now that it's just, he's so long gone. All you can do is take him at his word and you can hear the result of it. I'm just saying, like, you put on, and again, I'm only using Double Fantasy as an example because it's pretty much all we got. You know, you can talk about Sometime in New York City. That's the closest thing probably to it, where they each have songs and stuff like that. So all we've got is this commercial distillation of that creative relationship. And we can go by that. And it's pretty solid, man. I mean, you can at least tell they put everything they had into it. And I mean everything. I mean, we thought of it back then as, 5 years went by and now he's back. As you said yourself, these were songs he had lying around. They did work on this album for about 5 years. It's just that once it came to the surface creatively, they went in and did it. But there's no way that album was not percolating for 5 years or more. That album was absolutely percolating. And they finally just felt the window, and sure, they would say, Yoko thought it, the astrologically it was right to do whatever they want to say. The point is that album was percolating and they saw the window and they jumped through it and they made the goddamn record. And then unfortunately, he was cut down. So we don't have any kind of aftermath from the point of view of a John Lennon. Should he not have been gunned down, I think it would still have been battered. Obviously, it would have been battered more. It got a little good graces because he was gunned down. But I think it would have been battered, and it would have been battered more, and I think it would have been then basically dismissed. It might have been exceeded by something else that he did. But I do believe that people would have come around to it and seen it now that we can come around to that era of punk and new wave and 1980 and New York. I mean, it's we haven't even talked about how New York that record is, how 1980 New York it is. It's like encased in amber. It's the epitome. It's a bubble of that time with the musicians and with the attitudes and the sounds and everything. So it's kind of cool to hear for that too. In other words, it's almost inextricable in many ways from, in John's case, some of the New York pop sensibilities, the Billy Joel and that kind of stuff coming on. And then in Yoko's case, almost like the Bowie and the Iggy Pop and all that stuff happening in New York. So it's kind of got all that right in it. So that's kind of what I'm saying is that it's nice to look at it in retrospect. It's nice to look at it and just see, what do we actually have here? What are we holding? In the case of I'm Your Angel, we're holding something that's incredibly intricate, really well, you know, lawsuit or not, it's still just like, there's Honey Pie, there's, you know, When I'm 64. And then we're looking at, you know, the Japanese gospel, like as you put it, of
Hard Times Are Over.
Of Hard Times Are Over, which is a beautiful song, which is an absolute devastatingly beautiful song.
It's been very long, but it's getting
you take something like Watching the Wheels, which is, I don't give a shit what anyone says, that's one of his best songs, straight up, one of his best tracks, one of his best songs. That's top of the line Lennon, as is, you could argue, maybe Woman too. You know, there's a couple tracks, Lennon tracks on there, is the best he's got, especially for the time. So that's all I'm saying is that I can only speak for myself. I've been looking back at that record and thinking, I'm only bringing this up because I can finally hear it. Not so much shadowed by the assassination. I could just finally listen to it that way. That's kind of why I brought it up to you, because I was like, finally put on that album and just like, it's not the first thing that came to my mind. But how are younger people hearing it? They weren't even there. I would argue that they're probably hearing it with a lot clearer ears. But I do hear a lot of dynamic, a lot of color, a lot of thought went into it. I hear a lot of kind of ingenious production touches. I hear a lot of collaboration, a lot of good times, a lot of laughter, a lot of hard work. I just hear what it takes to make a great record in that. But I don't know if it's changed for you.
Well,
I mean, for better or worse, I don't know if you are able to listen to it in that same way where it's not immediately colored by the murder.
I've gotten past that point for sure. But then other issues popped up, which I've alluded to. I think that there's a good possibility from what you're describing as your own evolution and viewing and hearing that album, that it may end up as sort of his Ram.
No, that's exactly what I was going to say. It's totally his Ram. He's a little late to the game on that because he didn't really let himself have domestic bliss. He's not a McCartney. He's just not the same type of musician.
Well, he was more concerned with the external at that time. He was all about preaching to the world, where McCartney was the absolute opposite. We're going to hunker down at home in Scotland, build a family, and just enjoy that life. And John didn't become that till later in life.
No, I think it's absolutely his Ram. And in many ways, and again, I'm going to get pilloried and crucified, but you know, I think in many ways it's a more successful Ram. Because let's face it, Paul and Linda McCartney, I don't hear a lot of Linda.
Really?
I don't. I don't really hear her influence that much in the sense like you would hear Yoko on Double Fantasy. If Ram is to be what it's advertised as, is the two of them, I hear a McCartney masterpiece that Linda is then, there's sousaints and sprinkles of Linda all throughout it, which are beautiful and wonderful. And I think it's for her. It's meant for her, and her voice is in it here and there, but she's just another player in it. You know, I believe that he put her name in there more for the financial haven of not getting nailed on the publishing. She doesn't sing a song on the album.
Well, no, they don't alternate tracks. And I don't think she saw that as her place. There's, as you know, many levels of collaboration. And as John would say in the production credit for Plastic Ono Band, where he gives Yoko the credit for wind, you know, she's the atmosphere. She's the environment. So I think that's a lot of what I hear when I hear Ram, is this is definitely different from McCartney, and I think this is why. I think now she had a full seat at the table, certainly a microphone at the table, and was informing maybe the direction he was going with the music. As an example, and this is just anecdotally, she had really been a fan of his playing electric guitar and pushed him to do more of it. And when you hear that playing at the end of Too Many People, that's exactly the example she gives of, I love when he plays that angry guitar. But that's sort of beside the point.
She's all over it. I'm not saying she doesn't earn. He can do whatever the hell he wants, and they can do whatever they want. I'm just saying,
yeah, the nature
Double
of the
Fantasy
collaboration
is a more successful version of having a couple's album. That's all I'm saying.
It's different. You know, they're not blow for blow, round for round, the same as Double
but
Fantasy.
But it's absolutely just as catching commercial and just as experimental in its own way. Even if that's coming completely more from her side. But again, I think one point I would make about Double Fantasy is just because he's taking on the more palatable and commercial aspects of that album doesn't mean he's not fully behind the experimental side of Double Fantasy and the yoke that, I mean, at this point with his involvement with her, you just can't discount the fact we all know now he was never prouder than something like Walking on Thin Ice. It's where right. He was holding his hand when he was shot, for Christ's sakes. And he declared, this will be your first number one. And he was just, you could hear the pride.
Right. He's playing the roughs over and over again right. The night before he was killed.
And yeah. I believe that as proud of, as that point, he had been to the mountaintop. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm saying that he had done and seen it all. He didn't need to be proud of his own shit at that point. He needed to be proud of her. He was proud of her. And I believe he was more proud of the shit she was doing at that point than he was of himself. I know that is hard for your average Beatle fan. That's not palatable to your average Beatle fan, but it's just true. That's a truth that people need to understand, is that at that point, he didn't give a shit. He was happy to make great songs, happy to make pop and all that kind of stuff. But I believe he had more pride for what she was doing. That's what I believe.
Or was getting more satisfaction out of the world discovering what
yes.
he had been hearing
yes.
and seeing.
100%, yeah. because yeah. he knows he yeah. could like shit in a bottle and people would love it. He didn't. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, he knew he could put out anytime he
didn't
wanted.
He
could create right. a great pop song, just like McCartney. He reacted to coming up with, what was it?
I Don't Want to Face It.
I Don't Want to Face It. Or he could even do versions of her thing. A perfect example is, in a way, every man has a woman who loves him. Because not only is that a haunting, incredible haunting track on that, that's just a track that holds up for all time. There's a version of him singing it, I guess as a guy track, or it's his harmony. It's like it's a lot
yeah,
of harmony
yeah.
on it.
From the Every Man Has a Woman comp.
Oh my God. Yeah. And that is just as believable and satisfactory version of that song. You can fully see their creative partnership integrated in that song. You know, I guess he whipped out the Rickenbacker, the classic Rickenbacker, for the first time on Walking on Thin Ice and does that incredible guitar work on that. I mean, left and right, it hits you. Boom, boom, boom. All the incredible things that he did on her tracks, whether production-wise or instrumentally or with whatever suggestion you made, that he was just so immensely proud of. I, like you said, I think he got off on the world getting off on her. And they may not have even been prepared and to love it as much as he did. Again, I'm not saying that any of that stuff was, you know, without fault or that was totally rational of him and all that. But I do believe that the world is catching up to his vision of her. I do believe that. I think we're at a point now where we can see, any Beatle fan worth their salt has to concede that this is a woman of immense talent. As whether we like things she did personally, or, you know, even like her personally, or whatever beef people have with her, you've got to take it. You know, or she would be nothing without his, okay, that, you know, great. The Beatles would be nothing without George Martin, Brian Epstein. Like, everyone would be nothing without somebody. But the point is that she is a great artist that has to be reckoned with. And I don't know how much longer she'll be around, but when she's gone, you'll see. You will see what people start to say. There's going to be your usual mixed shit, the usual disgruntled shit from whatever, but there will be a reappreciation of her way outscaling the reappreciation that's already gone on. For better or worse, she's going to be remembered as a great artist. It's not, I believe it's not been without my own personal evolution on her.
Uh-huh.
I didn't always feel that way. But now you kind of listen to like the first Plastic Ono Band album she did, or listen to things that John Leckie says about her, or, you know, or listen to things that people say about her later, artists that you love that you realize in retrospect took a great inspiration from her. And you go back and listen to stuff and you go, even some of it, like Feeling the Space, which is not even that avant-garde. And you think, hold on a minute. She had a lot of harmonic, melodic, and lyrical know-how well beyond what I imagined that she did when I was younger. I could go on and on. Honestly, like lyrically, her influence on John is incalculable. The minimalism and the sort of haiku-like poetry and that sort of looking at things as up, down, and left, right, and all that kind of stuff in black, white. And so, I mean, you could just take a deep dive into just her influence on him and you would never come out. Arguably.
Very well said.
It's just with my epiphany of hearing that album recently and listening to the 1980, a lot of documentary and 1980 stuff like on Yesterday and Today, and going, wait a second, man. I mean, I've been through the experience of making records and I recognize what they were going through as what you go through when you're really trying to make something profound, tempting. And it's, you kind of give it everything you got. You kind of give a piece of yourself. And you could tell that they did that on that record. And I was finally starting to hear that. So that's why I was kind of putting out there the thought of having that discussion about it. But, you know, I'm sure I'll get some blowback. I don't really care.
It's food for thought. This is exactly what the show is all about. I'm a lot more comfortable putting out suggestions or think of it this way than this is how it is, man. People might reflexively want to push back and say, oh, he's full of shit, blah, blah, blah. Or they might think, well, wait a minute. Well, that's probably true. And I can hear that now. I think you've set in motion a process that maybe people will start to rediscover. And I tell you, the day she drops dead and people go back to listen to this show, they're going to say, holy shit, he was onto something.
Well, it's like, how many of these people have honestly sat down and really listened to Feeling the Space and really gone, oh my God, you know, this is like some a Steely Dan version of an avant-garde record. Like, there's so much in there that I haven't even dove into. Am I saying I want to hear her fucking go, and scream at, you know, like a sheep at the top of her lungs? For, no, but that's not what all her shit is.
Lecky does.
Lecky does, likes that, but, you know, yes. He's cutting edge, man. But I appreciate that. But I really wasn't, my whole, whatever you will, treatise or whatever was really just, you know, so they used to always say, like, listen to this picture, you know, to this album. It's staggering. It's staggering work of, if not genius, then creative intent, a staggering work of collaboration and belief in each other. Her believing in him for sure, but boy, him believing in her to the level of, I'm not sure McCartney got that level of belief in him past 65. In that sense, of just that unadulterated belief. I'm all in on this guy as my creative partner. In other words, unwavering, not wavering.
Not conditional.
Unconditional, yeah. And you can hear it there. You can hear it almost to the point where he's, as he was wont to do, just sort of claw, like with his claws, just like holding on to her almost for dear life. Almost like she's got the strength and she's got the upper hand and he's getting stronger. But unfortunately, before he could really get strong, he was cut down. But I don't know. I know you want to wrap it up, but I'm just wondering, what do you think people would have thought about this record, either in the aftermath or even, you know, 10, 20 years down the line, had he not been cut down so close to it? So 10 years later or 20 years later, you know?
Right. Some of it might have depended on what he did after that. I have to tell you, I've never been a fan of the song Grow Old With Me, ever. To me, it's schlocky, corny, insincere reeking. It's like the sound of somebody trying too hard.
Sure.
And John Lennon, being the one who produced it, puts that on a higher plane, I think, where you get more into sacrilege if you say or think something like that. But imagine it came from Billy Joel. You'd have no problem hating all over it, right? That said, Nobody Told Me, fantastic track. I've always had a soft spot for Flower Princess on Milk and Honey. So I'm just talking about the stuff that he had in his pocket.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was never a big fan of Stepping Out, and I don't want to face it. Great track. So I think he still had some mojo. And so what he would have done with it going forward, I think that ultimately, had the tragedy not happened, it would have looked like a good first step. Maybe one of those middling albums like Mind Games, where it's some good stuff and some meh stuff on it. But I think that, in a way, the tragedy, on one hand, there was the overcompensation of focusing all your sense of love and loss onto this album that exalted it and put it on this pedestal that maybe didn't warrant. But the further we get from December 1980, it's like the same trip you've been on, where you're hearing it now with 21st century ears, and how forward-thinking that a woman, not of rock and roll, he was giving her the equal spotlight, integrating her into his art, and lo and behold, she's the one being more real, being more edgy and raw, where he's being a little pulling his punches on that album.
A little coy.
Yeah, for sure. I think that with that sensibility, by the world we find ourselves living in now, would have been looked back at as like, wow, well, maybe they really were onto something, and maybe this was more successful than we gave it credit for, because we were so clamoring for a new John Lennon record. Instead, we got a half of one, and from somebody that we didn't care for back in 72 for sometime in New York City either.
I think John Lennon in now has to get a lot, and I mean a shitload of credit, for being unwavering about her creatively, and a woman in general, and giving her that equal billing. It's looking really good now, in light of the fact that today, arguably, it's kind of a woman's moment in music. All you have to do is just check out Pitchfork, or just see what's going on, or just see who's ruling the charts. If it's not Lizzo, it's Beyonce, or people that are not just commercial, people that are considered experimental or cutting edge, they all seem to be women, whether they're cut from the Kate Bush school, or cut from the Aretha Franklin school, or whatever it is, or cut from the Yoko school. That's a school too. And I think that we're living through a moment now in 2022 where it's finally at the point where not only is a woman's place in music, it's not even really questioned now. It's just kind of like understood. And a lot of that has to do with the sacrifices behind the scenes that I think that Lennon did make, of just just like not caring if he alienated his fans and not caring if he alienated his friends. I don't want to be one of those that's like, it's because of the man behind the woman. That's not what I'm trying to say.
No, no,
I'm not trying to say that. I'm just trying to say that
the man held the power back then. So for him to be willing to lose that by going out on that particular limb is an act of bravery unto itself.
A woman into literally the stratosphere with cutting edge stuff, not being like a Streisand or someone who could easily, you know, or Donna Summer who could puncture through on a pop level, but really puncture through on an avant-garde level, you do have to use your clout as number one in the creative world. I still say that there's not many that would have done that. You know, Paul might have done that had Linda had aspirations to be that. I believe that Paul would have done that.
I think so too. And I think therein lies a big difference. Yoko clearly had ambitions, wanted to be once she got into John's orbit. And I'm not saying this as a judgment. I'm saying as a reality that even Dan Richter, who was her friend, said he was quite forward about she wanted to be a rock star.
That's right.
And she thought she had a place on the stage at Bangladesh. She just was like, of course I am.
Well, and that's what I'm getting at. That gets to the crux of what I'm saying is that I've always looked at that. I admit, I confess, I've looked at that in a negative light my whole life as a Beatles fan. And I do not continue to look at that negatively anymore. Who gives a fuck if she goes up and caterwauls at a Bangladesh show? Sure, it was George's trip. My point is, like, I don't anymore see those boundaries. And I think that Lennon can be forgiven now in retrospect for also not seeing them then, whereas everybody else saw them. And understandably so for the time.
This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp.com, online professional therapy. It's been sort of a subtext to this show for as long as it's been on. If the Beatles had an implicit message about anything, it was about pursuing the light and the healthy and the positive. The theme of Yellow Submarine was no random thing. It actually completely aligned with who they aspired to be and the ideals they projected. BetterHelp makes it so much easier than traditional in-person therapy to do this. Being within reach online through video, chats, and by phone. Accessible most everywhere in the world with professional licensed therapists. And as a listener to this podcast, you can get 10% off your first month of treatment by going to BetterHelp, that's help, not health, as in the song and the film, .com/SATB, S-A-T-B, to get 10% off your first month of treatment. Now back to the second half of my conversation.
But that's what I'm kind of pinpointing at, is that, yeah, you know, looking back on it, it was kind of a boys' club, and it was kind of lame, and it was kind of like he was one of the first, if not the first, to finally, the thing that Chris and Nancy were talking about, Lennon wasn't like that. He was one of the few odd men out who were not like that. Sure, he pulled guy shit. There's no doubt about it. He pulled just male stuff. But when it comes to letting the woman in to the room creatively, he did not balk. He did not falter. He pushed her in there and was like, gave her a seat at the table. And his creative legacy will age well, I think, because of that. That's all I'm kind of deriving from taking another little glance at Double Fantasy. It's kind of like, wow, just to look at it. Now I'm like 51. It's like, I can look back at this record. I was 10 when it came out, for Christ's sakes. And I was even a Beatles fan then. I was a Lennon fan then. I was on the edge of my seat when that came out. And I can actually look back and go, wow, it's so cool to realize this about my hero. Essentially, he was my hero. I had a hero gunned down, as many did. No more than a hero than when God, when you're that young. And even you were pretty damn young. And that's fascinating to me that you were of teenage age. You work in a record store and you can kind of see it, its place in the marketplace at the time and what it meant to the scene and stuff like that. I wasn't even aware of that. I was just like, oh my God, Lennon. Don't get me wrong. You know, I'm really critical of Lennon. Just as much as I'm less critical in that way, I'm more critical in other ways. I don't think, you know, his 70s output is that strong after Plastic Ono. Whereas growing up, I thought it was really strong. Like, I was like, thought it was the greatest thing in the world. And I see Paul as having pulled up and possibly surpassed him looking back. So there's a lot of perceptions that have changed for me. But one that's definitely been added is this championing of Yoko and of the woman being allowed to be more of a Kate Bush type figure in, you know, or Marianne Bjork. Faithful. Bjork, absolutely a direct line to something like, again, Bjork, you know, not everyone's thing and not really my thing, but there's no denying her influence and her power and her place at the table. There's a direct line without a doubt, from Yoko to Bjork. I mean, 1,000%. So I just hope it gets people thinking about, if anything, I just hope it gets people listening to the record, you know, in a different way. And also just going back to her stuff and realizing, wow, I mean, those people that were hip to her are the ones that changed rock and roll.
Well said.
Yeah, man.
That's great. This is so cool. You're getting my wheels turning, and that's...
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I know you have been on the other side of the fence, but I'm only telling you what my evolution has been. If you talk to me even like 3 years ago, I may not even been having this conversation.
And you're not here to proselytize. You're saying, imagine, you know.
Absolutely.
Listen to it with fresh ears. Consider this possibility. And I am considering it, and I'm like, wow, okay.
Oh, I'm considering, like, when he said, Christ, you know it ain't easy. I'm starting to consider, like, he was feeling like he was nailed to the cross because of his unwavering support of Yoko artistically, even. Like, just not even just the fact that she was Japanese and a woman and all this stuff. And I mean, let's admit, he put an arrow into the Beatles bubble that was, it could not have been more sharpened and more pointed in the sense of like, let's go. Okay. It's just World War II was, you know, like how long ago? And, you know, she's Japanese. She's on the absolute cutting edge of the avant-garde. She screams at the top of her, you know, he just took, he lobbed a Molotov cocktail into the Beatles. You can really look about it. But, you know, looking back on it, you almost got to go like, how else could he have done it? He couldn't have like grandfathered her in. It's like you kind of had to just chuck the baseball, you know, and that's what he did. And I really admire him for it. I mean, I don't even think he knew what he was doing. I think he was doing what he normally does, which is go on his total instinct. That's why I don't think he was a troll. I don't think he was a troll. I think if anything, he was just a little too impulsive.
Yes.
He was an impulsive guy, but he was impulsive about a very, very good instinctual quality that he had. His instinct is why the Beatles are so great.
His instinct was not completely self-serving. I think ultimately, had the Beatles been accepting, he saw it to the greater good. Let's shake things up. Let's do something different. Let's stay ahead of the pack.
And that's
nobody's going to see this coming.
And that's it. Staying ahead of the pack. His instinct was always perfect for that. You know, they say in like whatever it is, like in modern music or commercial music or whatever, it's like you want to be ahead of everybody, but not too far ahead. That's like the thing of Brian Wilson, like when he was doing Pet Sounds, like he just ahead enough, but really skirting the line because Smile was a bridge too far, apparently. So it's about being the pop genius of the time of the 60s was about being just an inch or two ahead, far enough ahead of the pack to where people thought you were the one leading, but the truth is you were just paying attention enough. But I think in Yoko, that's the first time where John Lennon was just too far ahead. Just too, a little too far ahead of his time. He saw a little too far into the future with her, and it just was a prisoner of its time, basically.
They weren't ready.
You get a set that sense, kind of?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
And that's why it was such a revelation to see that George leaves, they jam moment. When they do that jam, it's almost like this crazy window. It's really, in a way, it could, besides the roof, it's almost like a favorite moment because you just kind of see the future that he saw for the Beatles. But unfortunately, it's impacted and encased and shrouded in misguided thoughts and things like that. But for a moment there, musically, if you just strip it down to pure music, enthusiasm, inspiration, it's gold, man.
An early clue to the new direction.
An early clue to the new direction. For sure, man. For sure, man. I got to tell you, I think it's a great subject. I didn't want to be hardline or anything. I could sense our opinions about things diverge, but not in a negative way, but just more in a way of like...
Perspective.
All I was doing was saying, I think we have to pull back the lens here and look at this in a much, much bigger scope. Like, this is, again... the talking points are there because he was killed in a weird way. We don't get him explaining himself after people are able to hear this. He's only explained himself. Like, how many interviews did he actually do with the record out?
With the record out? Not as many. I mean,
it couldn't have been that.
RKO and BBC, like, the weekend he was killed, but most of that press had been done before.
Right. So those are the interviews to me that really need some focus, because those are the ones that he now can be aware
of how it's being received.
Well, because when you're talking about something, you do this press leading up to the, you even do it now, you do all this PR leading up to the release of a record, no one's heard a note. And you don't know how anyone's going to perceive it. So you're sort of talking about something people don't know what you're talking about.
Peter Jackson on Satby.
Exactly. Peter Jackson on Satby, which, you know, I can't remember if you did a post it being out thing with him, but I don't think you did.
No, the entire talk was before anybody had seen a frame of it.
That's a little bit of a bummer, because I do believe that would be a different conversation.
Well, his thinking, and he explained it to me, is that, therefore, you don't know what's in it. We're going to talk about a broader range of things than if you just restrict yourself to what I put on the screen.
I get his instinct on that. I totally get that. And I think there's a lot more wonder in it. And there's a lot more, you know, enthusiasm. But I think that to focus in on those conversations that John had before he was gunned down is to get a little glimpse of the man in the world that heard the record and could see what he was talking about. And he might be, I could be wrong, but he could be a little more real in those, or he could be less real. I don't know.
I would think he'd be more real because he would have to directly respond to people's observations about what they heard.
Yeah. And the question is, in the RKO and the BBC interview, how real is he being? He's getting good news on the record. You know, a lot of the bad stuff isn't coming in yet. There's a calmness you get from, like, this thing's finally out.
Yeah, right.
I don't have to talk it up. I only have to talk about it.
It's less frantic, yeah.
It's less frantic, and I think there is this zen thing in him. And you can tell if his wheels are turning, it's on what's next. Because that's who he is, and that's who he always.
Very much so.
Even Yoko. And it's really interesting to hear her in those interviews, because, you know, you can tell that she is still glad to be at the table, but you can still sense her reticence of, like, I used to perceive it as a reticence of, like, she wants the world to come back to him. So she's letting him have that spotlight because, you know, it's been a long time and she knows the fans want to hear from. She knows who he is. But at the same time, there's also part of that reticence is because I think she senses still that in 1980, people are not ready yet for a woman to be taken that seriously as people would start to take, say, Marianne Faithfull with Broken English and Kate Bush with the stuff that she did, and women that were really challenging the men out there that were challenging music. Mm-hmm. She knew she was one of them. And I think there's a reticence to, like, you can sense inside of her. It's just boiling over. Like, she wants to just grab the microphone.
Yoko wants a mic.
Not out of being, like, a total egotistical bitch or whatever, but just out of, like, hey, I'm here too. And I have a voice and I've got things to say that are going to be more relevant to the future than even he's saying. But she doesn't do that. She doesn't do it. She just is cool. She's very cool.
The way I looked at it was probably it's an album that's not going to do too well. But in the end, you know, maybe like 2 years later or something, people said, that was good. Because I knew that the theme was good. I knew the dialogue was important, etc. And each song was all right, you know. So I had a feeling that even if it takes a long time, people would know about it, you know. But I didn't know it was going to be that instant, you know.
Then he's just gone. Then he's just gone. And it's so tragic because of all the things that we grew up with and we knew, but really tragic because of the moment. The moment was kind of like very, very unique, very like, you can't make this shit up. It was weird, right? I mean, remember at the time out, there was almost a grating contrast between the aftermath and the prelude. It was like a record scratch. You know what I mean? It was just like, it's over. And he just said starting over. I really think listening again, if anyone's interested and listens to that Yesterday and Today podcast, and they're great for the whole As It Happens thing, but especially for 1980 and into 81, it's like unbelievable to go back in time and just hear that all happen in real time, all with the vigil in Central Park and everything. she handled herself really, really well. I can't even imagine what she was going through, and I can't even imagine how she even knew what to do. And it's all she ever seemed to do was take flack for the way she handled things, the putting the glasses on the cover and all these kind of things. But the truth is that in the moment, thank God it was her. Thank God it was her just saying, you know, the things she said and calling for that. I participated in that moment of, I think it was 10 minutes of silence.
Yeah, yeah.
And everyone did it. And it was kind of like this real moment that people had together. And I don't know. She just, looking back on it, I thought she handled that situation pretty good. And okay, I don't know how she handled it interpersonally. I know Julian would probably beg to differ. There's a lot of inside shit. But as far as to the greater world, outer world.
Right, right. The messaging.
The messaging, I thought, was pretty good on it.
Yeah, it was on point.
Yeah. It gets weird to look at it the two ways from 40 years on and then to be have been able to have been there at the time. It was so unspeakable then. So this is the thing. These days, it's kind of hard to get shocked. We're having a tough time getting shocked by anything. Like something comes at you in the news, it's 24 news cycle. You're shocked for like a second. That was being shocked for real and for way more than a second. Like we're still feeling the after reverberations. I know it sounds crazy to just think, oh, a pop star. These days, it sounds silly to people who weren't around. Oh, a pop star was gunned down and you give a shit. Yeah, that just didn't happen. And the last people anyone expected to shoot was a Beatle. It seemed it seemed unthinkable. It was unthinkable. And now we're in a time where we're so post that now we can look at it with a different lens of tragedy. We can look at it from this lens of like what would have been.
Right. What we lost.
What we lost. Because we've seen Paul just give a concert the other day and a great show, supposedly by all accounts, at Glastonbury. And Ringo out on the road doing his thing. And you know, we just know what they all did. And it's like, oh my God, we know we lost now a lot of music. We lost a shit ton of music. And we should probably be grateful that Yoko even got it together to make more music. And it's just, we can just look at it really differently. Whereas at the time, it was just the worst possible, worst possible timing and the worst possible thing that could have happened. From the standpoint of pretty much every music fan. So it's kind of weird, you know? It's weird to live in a time where we can feel both those things as Beatle fans.
And also to know that people of today who weren't there then will never understand it.
No. The reason they'll never understand it is simply from one word, context. They just don't have the context of what the Beatles meant then, how still what a powerful commercial force they were. And then beyond that, this weird thing of this Howard Hughes kind of guy at the time going away and everybody really just not having an internet, just everybody was wondering like, will we ever get Lennon music? 5 years was a lifetime in pop. And then suddenly coming back, like sort of supernova-like, almost Phoenix-like.
Jesus on Easter.
It's like Jesus on Easter coming back and then getting crucified all over again, right in the next minute. I mean, it was that impactful. It was kind of crazy. It was like whether or not you were even if, you know, you read all these accounts, but I never even liked Lennon. I never thought. There's not a single person alive that liked him or not that thought it was some fantastic thing that he was gunned a shot from behind, you know, four or five shots in the back in front of his wife on the street holding a cassette of her music. Right after having finished his latest record and no one heard from him in a long time, let alone the fact he was not only a Beatle, but the Beatle, the guy who basically started it all. It made you look at life and kind of go, really? I thought it was bad, but really? That's not what we're doing now? We're shooting Beatles? There was that moment, I think, that collective consciousness of everyone kind of felt it, young or old. You looked at them and went, God, that's where we're at now, huh? Like, it wasn't even a political act. It's actually a misnomer to call it an assassination. He was a political figure, but he was not as killed for political reasons.
Right.
It was just a murder, just a lousy New York murder. And it's like, God damn it, it kind of was that feeling. Everyone just felt kind of like, no one is safe, I guess. No one's anyone susceptible. And it really hasn't changed. You know, like, we're still living in this time where it's just like, good luck. It's kind of I really do feel like that. Do you feel the same way that was some weird dividing line?
Yeah, only now it's mass shootings.
Exactly.
My brother doing Lollapalooza, we had a family call with, you know, what happened with my dad, and that got floated and said out loud. It's like, you know, and, you know, be careful, be safe. And it's like, yeah, because this is the world we live in now.
you could be working a concert and somebody decides to spray it up with bullets. Yeah, that's a real possibility, brother.
Yeah, and I really feel like the moment you could do that, you know, I mean, the reason it was called an assassination, let's be real, and I'm fine if you use all this, I don't really care, because I think it's important to talk about, but the reason it was called an assassination, and I've had a lot of time to think about it, is because it was a shooting on a mass consciousness level as MLK, to the point where it was just everyone knew about it, it affected everyone in some way, so it felt like an assassination, but it wasn't, it was just a murder.
Well, it was a celebrity being murdered because of who they are.
Right, sure.
A life was taken, not because you were being robbed or,
right.
You know, it's something in the moment. It was, I'm killing you because you are John Lennon.
Misguided or not, that's what I'm getting at is that is the moment you can pinpoint where all bets are off at that point. Because once that happens, there's no really letting that, putting that genie back in the bottle, that evil genie. It's like, I really believe you can trace a direct line right down here to mass shootings. You know, Harry Nilsson campaign, as we all know, you know, for handgun violence, the Bernard, people forget about the Bernard Goetz thing.
Oh, yeah.
And all that stuff.
What you're reminding me of is like 3 months later, Reagan gets shot.
Yes.
That was far less shocking to me than what happened 2 months later, which was the Pope getting shot. It's like,
you know,
really?
What? You're right.
Now we're shooting the Pope?
Well, this is the thing. Violence on that level is almost self-multiplying like cancer cells are and stuff. And it's funny you bring that up because that's what a lot of people don't remember. Lenin was shot and then right away Reagan was shot and then the Pope was shot. There was that kind of recall to the late 60s where all of a sudden these massive figures are getting shot because why? Because they can.
Yeah. Anwar Sadat. Do you remember that one? Sprayed up by his military.
That's right. And I'm sure if you kind of think about it longer, there was more and more. And the point is that it never stopped. But political figures or public figures or commercial figures or whatever are nothing if not a thing we look to as some sort of barometer. If you can do that, you could do this to anyone now. Because they're figures that are in everyone's consciousness. So yeah, I fully believe that that led to this and this led to that and that led to, and all of a sudden, we're just killing people. Now we have weaponry. If people had access to the kind of weaponry that people do now, you could have just gone in and, we've had those shootings in France when people shot at the audience, people shot at the band. I mean, you could have just straight up killed a band back then. You could have wiped a band off the face of the earth back. You could do it now, certainly, but I don't want to condone that and even put that out there. But the point is that we were only limited by really the means by which people could even perpetrate those sort of acts.
Right.
So it's kind of like, I see the Leninist, whatever, if you will, assassination or at least murder as a flashpoint. And, such a massive flashpoint that, of course, like a star exploding or something, it's just going to dwarf everything else in its immediate aftermath, including an album that was made, just a little old album, just a bunch of people that drank and smoked and had a good time in a studio trying to make a cool thing for the people. That was overshadowed completely, and it's never been unshadowed. So I feel like it's actually a very undiscussed topic of conversation because of that in a weird way. People have talked about it only, like you said, as sort of a talking point and with talking points, but not as taken for this intended piece of art that it was. So I really appreciate even the discussion with someone like yourself who has the academic knowledge and the sense of the setting and the way the table was set when all this shit went down. But to be able to, but also we're both around now and we both actually discuss it. We were both there and can discuss it now. That's super cool. That's like really different. Because you can at least see what I'm getting at.
Yeah, absolutely. You can see what was set in motion 40 years ago, what it brought us to today, and connect the dots.
Yeah, connect the dots. But part of me didn't want to get in the discussion again, because like I was walking, taking a walk today, and I'm just listening to a little bit of it and thinking, even when I went to listen to it, I went, I guess I got to listen to this. It's like double fantasy will all have this thing of like, there'll always be that hesitation. Because if you were there, it's wrapped up in a lot of feelings.
Yeah.
It's got lot of baggage, man. And even to this day, like I'll never be able to put it on and enjoy it, even if it's Sgt. Pepper itself. But it's funny because Sgt. Pepper happened to Brian Epstein, but it wasn't like, but if Sgt. Pepper had been made and then it was one of them that passed away, believe me, we'd be looking at Sgt. Pepper a very
completely different.
And so I think that that's, and thank God that didn't happen. But it's kind of partially why we look at Let It Be a little differently and see that black cover as, you know, black and funereal and stuff. Funereal. So I'm just saying, where you look at this record, like, I'll just never be able to listen to it without that little hesitation. But I can, like I said it earlier in the conversation, I can finally listen to it with a little bit of openness.
Yeah.
And what I start to see and start to hear is pretty staggering.
Right.
Yeah.
Fresh eyes, fresh ears.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah.
It's good to do another jam with you, man. I was worried like, oh God, will I have as much gas in the tank as I did when we last discussed it? But as it turns out, it's a really juicy subject.
And it's not one that was an obvious one for me to have come up with. So thank you for that.
Awesome. You bet, man.
Something About the Beatles, created and hosted by Robert Rodriguez, sponsored by BetterHelp. Go to betterhelp.com/sappy for 10% off your first month. Executive producer Rick Way, title song by The Corgis. We'll be right back.
Ah, mmm. The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.